Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hello, everybody. It's great to see you on this Monday, July 7th. And we are recording this for you just about 90 minutes from the area most impacted by this historic flooding in Texas. I'm looking out my window right now as I'm talking to you, and I see nothing but gray skies, clouds and gray skies, and a constant beat of rain that has been ever present over the last several days. What I hope to do today for you is, because of our close proximity to this massive news event, and also because of the way that has clearly affected our entire community here at Smarter News, but really nationwide, I want to take a moment to take a deep breath with you. There's been a lot of news coming at you over the last several days. It's news that can quickly move you to tears. It's hard not to be impacted by news that involves children. And this is true of so many stories that we cover that involves children, innocent children, that find themselves in the middle of a news story due to nothing that they did themselves, no decisions that they made. And so that's not lost on me. And in an era of rapid fire headlines, I just want to take that deep breath with you to work through what has transpired in Texas over the last several days. There's so many questions, and there's a plethora of different news stories. And so I want to organize it for you so hopefully we can take it in and process it. One of the things I was thinking about today is the 24-hour news cycle. And when I used to be on a news program that would last for 2 hours, you had to really think about filling that time. Sure, a lot of the news stories were obvious. You know, you had this story out of Washington, D.C., you had another story out of Texas, maybe another one out of California. You were going to hit these. And then you had a bunch of other stories that maybe you'd cover, maybe you didn't. Sometimes they would be slotted in and you would go into the program not knowing whether they would come up or not, depending on timing. But you still had that time to fill. And that would lead you to entertain stories that maybe you otherwise would not. You know, if I was really thinking about you as the priority, would I include such and such story at 42 minutes into our broadcast? The hope is that all the stories are valuable, but sometimes the conversations can sort of lean into a lot of hypothetical situations or what ifs, or we're going to have sort of this live brainstorm or debate about a topic. And sometimes then the news value would fall. One of the things I see with breaking news stories like the ones that we experienced in Texas is there's a lot of conversation about the what ifs, which is natural. And there's a lot of sort of this constant chewing over of old information, which doesn't necessarily allow us to then take in the news, process it, and then try to move into the next, whatever the next chapter is. So I just want to recognize that. One of the other things I want to recognize is that a lot of our news stories over the last several weeks have been forward-leaning, meaning, yes, we're covering the big, beautiful bill, but we're wondering what's going to happen from that bill. Yes, we're covering what's happening in the Middle East, but the question is, are we leading to war? You know, there's a question about what's going on with the economy. We have the economic data now, but really the question is, what does it look like in 6 months? And again, this is part of reporting. As you've listened to me over the years, one of the key questions I ask in a lot of our interviews is, what's next? What do we watch next? That's a natural human tendency. But in order to look at what's next, we actually have to know what's going on. And sometimes we're moving too quickly to the what next or what ifs without actually understanding what happened, what just happened. This is part of the tension we saw when I was covering the big, beautiful bill, because it was changing so quickly. To be able to really think into what's going to happen 2 or 3 years into Medicaid was very difficult. And so you can see that I really hesitated from doing that because I want to be accurate and I also want to know what's going on. And sometimes we actually didn't know it. So what we're going to do today is talk about what's going on. You know, what really is at the heart of this disaster? How did this transpire? What are some of the factors that are involved? And how does that impact some of the questions we're asking forward-looking? You know, what can be done to prevent this? What decisions were made in the past that then impacted this? And then what could we do better? It's not that we shouldn't ask those questions. I believe in all questions, as you know. I want all the questions to be asked, but I want those questions to be rooted in something as firm as possible. A lot of the developments or different variables are changing on the ground now in Texas, but we do have an idea of what happened. So I want to walk through that. Real quick before I do, a couple of things I just want to put on your radar, a little bit of housekeeping here. I think it's important for you to know that Congress is back in session in Washington, D.C. So the big, beautiful bill was passed. The president signed it into law over the July 4th weekend. It is the law of the land. And now we will start looking at what the effects of that will be. In the meantime, Congress is in session really for the next several weeks before they also then will go back to their districts for a little bit in late summer. So what do the next several weeks look like is a question, because there was also the question about whether or not Congress would continue to have to tackle this legislative package. Now that's off their desk. We'll see what their priorities become and what happens next there. But they are in Washington, D.C., so we expect some news from Congress this week. We don't have a ton of hearings or anything for me to really flag for you. I think it's important to know where Congress is. In the meantime, the president is at the White House. He's going to be greeting Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. And one of the questions we're going to be asking with this is about a potential ceasefire between Israel and Hamas regarding Gaza and the way forward in Gaza. The president indicated that we could see something later in the week. What that could be, we don't know, but the meeting is happening today at the White House. Also happening this week is a deadline that the president set regarding tariffs, saying, hey, if we don't have a deal, remember the 90 days that he was giving countries? All right, we're going to give you 90 days, or we're going to try to figure it out because we have some momentum and we feel like deals are going to come together. Those 90 days are over on Wednesday. And so I would expect to see, and I'm already seeing this morning, a variety of competing headlines. It looks like things are coming together, or maybe they're not. We're going to put 25% tariffs on you. Maybe we're going to put them on you. Maybe there's a change. Expect a lot of that going back and forth. It is deal making in the public eye using the press. So think about how the press is sort of being leveraged in this, because this is the way that the president is able to position himself and his administration about what they're going to do next in the sort of terms of these tariffs that they're looking for. So we're going to watch for any big deals announced. We're going to see if there's another delay, but this is also something I think you should be aware of. In the meantime, you have Elon Musk announcing also around, poetically around the Independence Day holiday, that he is launching a new political party. I just want to put that on your radar. What that looks like, we don't know. It is interesting to note that we just passed the anniversary of the first presidential debate last year that forever changed the course of presidential history. That was the debate between President Biden and President Trump, where there were questions that came to the forefront about President Biden's fitness to lead. That obviously changed the presidential race. Well, this week, we're also marking the anniversary of the assassination attempt of President Trump. And I flagged that for you because I want you to think about how much the political landscape changed after those two events, and also still how many questions there are about the assassination attempt. So I would expect that to come up and cross your desk this week. Just want you to know that it's out there. So we have some political news. We don't know how these stories are going to develop, but we'll continue to watch them. In the meantime, let's turn back to Texas. What I want to do quickly here first is that there was a press conference at 10 a.m. Central Time on Monday. By the time you listen to this, it could already be a little bit old. What I think is actually the most important part of this press conference is an understanding of how big the area is that is being searched. You're looking at just between 60 and 70 miles, square miles, of a grid system of search that's taking place. So this is a very extensive area with a lot of devastation. And a lot of coordination has to happen to search it effectively and quickly. And the timeline of that is TBD. Part of the reason for the timeline is a great concern about future flooding because, again, it continues to rain. The forecast looks better as we look into the week, but it's still a lot of rain on the ground. And for those who were out yesterday trying to help the recovery efforts or volunteer, some of them had to be pulled back and told, get to higher ground. Can you imagine that? So you're there in an area flooding that has already flooded. You're going through some of the absolutely awful devastation. Let me go ahead and share this with you so that you can see some of it. This is from Texas Park and Wildlife. There's a lot of different information out there, but I'm trying to stick close to what I can verify. So we have some pictures of the brush that is trying to be searched through. I mean, for those of you who are listening on podcasts, it is very difficult to describe because you're not just talking about trees that are down. You're talking about just all of this mud and foliage just layered on top of each other and having to painstakingly go through it just using your hands. You know, you can see some of the heavy equipment that's there, but in order to really effectively search this, it's taking a lot of equipment, a lot of people. And so in the middle of all of this yesterday, as people are trying to help, what they're finding is that they are being evacuated or alerts are happening. And obviously a lot of people are on edge, nerves are afraid, and there's a concern about safety. Now you have a lot of people in the area, some of which are attached to law enforcement and a lot of which are not. And so you don't really know who's there. Very similar to what happened during the flooding where you have campers there, not just campers at the camps, but campers that are there just for the holiday weekend, you know, just enjoying the river. And maybe even some family members didn't know that they were going. So are they counting in those missing or are they not? So these are some of the dynamics at play as we're going into this week. A lot of challenging search area, a huge search area, and a big concern about weather. So let's back up. Let's kind of go in reverse so that we can focus on what's happening today. And what I want to walk you through is a timeline. And I've pieced this timeline together through research, through talking to people on the ground who were impacted by the flood, also talking to some of those very much involved in search and rescue, and getting an idea of what happened several hours before this flooding took place. What should we know about that? For the average person in this area of Texas in the Hill Country, we knew that it was going to be a wet 4th of July. No one knew if there was actually going to be able to be fireworks. It looked like the weather was going to be pretty bad. But, you know, what that looked like could be a wide range. You know, is it a thunderstorm that lasts an hour during the morning, or is it something that brings a lot of rain all day? And what happened just from a personal perspective, again, 90 minutes away from the event of the flooding, as the rain started, very much overnight, even a little bit on Thursday, and just kept raining. So you wake up in the morning, we're waking up to some news about flooding that's taking place in Kerrville. No one's really understanding what that means quite yet, waking up the morning of July 4th. But let's go back to July 3rd. So important to know here that there was concern about weather and about flooding. To what extent that was sort of questionable. You know, could there be a flood warning? Sure. What does that actually look like? TBD. There was an alert that went out to some of those who would respond in emergency situations at a state and federal level. And they were told, hey, heads up, we could be seeing something here that could mean that you're not going to be able to spend July 4th with your family. You're going to have to come and you're going to have to respond to this. So there was a heads up about that early on the day before. So when we had news that transpired overnight, to some, that wasn't alarming because there was a heads up that we could see some water and some flooding. But again, seeing what we've seen, there was very little expectation of that. So we have alerts going out Thursday night. As we get into Friday, and I'm going to focus now on the National Weather Service, some of the weather alerts, what we start seeing is a change. So one of the things that I've learned is that what we're watching for with weather alerts, and I didn't know this until this time, is a considerable tag. There can be a flash flood warning in the area, but if you have a considerable tag, that means that could be catastrophic or a heads up of something bigger happening. So you're looking not just for a flash flood warning, you're looking for it almost to have this little tag on it that says, oh, no, this is elevated. And so this takes place at about 1:14 in the morning, that there is a high damage threats and a concern about what this flooding could look like. At this time, you can see automatically triggering some of these wireless emergency alerts. We're going to talk a little bit about that, that you would get on your phone. That sort of alert can trigger those alerts on your phone. Now, whether or not that happened is still a question of sort of being matched up. And who can actually push those alerts is something I'm going to tackle in just a moment. But this is a heads up that we could see life-threatening flash flood events and that you should have urgent public notification. So this is happening right in the middle of the night, the dead of night, 1 o'clock. You went to bed, not necessarily seeing it rain, or maybe it rained a little bit, but it's not like it's been raining for days. So you go to sleep, this is happening in the middle of the night. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning, there was another pretty significant alert. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, we learn of a flash flood emergency that's being alerted to the Kerr and Hunt County area, the Kerrville and Hunt area. And this is where some of the most catastrophic flooding took place. So that's happening at 4:03. And then an emergency is declared at 5:30 in the morning. 5:30, a flash flood emergency issued for the Guadalupe River. At this point, based on what our understanding of events, the flash flood has already come through. So 4 a.m., flash flood warning was upgraded to a flash flood emergency for parts of these counties. At 4:35, you have the first reports that there could be some flooding at low water crossings. By the way, low water crossings are very common in this part of the country. And that could mean, oh, there's some water on the road. There's an inch of water on the road. Just a heads up, there's some water on this low water crossing. It doesn't mean that there's 5 feet of water or 29 feet of water. It just means that there's some water. 4:35. 5 a.m., you have a National Water Center Area hydrological discussion, included concern for widespread considerable flooding throughout the day. The flood hazard outlook was upgraded to considerable and catastrophic. So between 4:35 of the first little water you're seeing at low water crossings to 5 o'clock, you have a massive change. And then 5:34 a.m., flash flood emergency issued for the Guadalupe River. Let me show you the Guadalupe River. And I'm going to try to pull up a little bit of a map. Let me stop sharing this with you. For those of you who are watching, I'm going to pull up a map. And I want you to look when you see kind of the brown area of the map, the Guadalupe River is originating from these natural springs. It's going to flow all the way down to the coast of Texas. And the area that it is flowing to a place called Canyon Lake. Canyon Lake is an area in the Hill Country. This is a beautiful lake, and a lot of people can, there's recreation around that lake. So you're seeing this river flow through this beautiful part of the Hill Country. It's called the Hill Country because of the hills. And you're seeing these vistas and these beautiful oak trees and cypress trees all over the place, all over this river, sort of canoping. In many ways, it does look like a fairy tale because you sometimes have these areas where it's super clear and super blue and just unbelievable for fishing and for families to enjoy and to kayak and to float and do all of these things. And so you're seeing this area from where the river really originates to Canyon Lake as being one of the key areas where this flooding is taking place, where there's a concern about this flooding. I want you to look at this area of land because this is also something that's being lost in the news. You're talking about a big area where, you know, going on a highway 75 miles per hour, you know, it's going to take you a while to cross this land. It's not like it's, you know, a straight shot of a flat highway through a rural part of Texas. You know, you're up and down and around on these curvy roads. You got a lot of these big vistas. You got big highways, but still a lot of people in and around this area. And the reason why I want to show you this map is because of what I want to show you next, which is where some of the storm was. You know, what did the forecast actually look like? So let me bring you to a local Houston network, and I want you to see part of the reason for this flooding, according to this forecaster, has to do with a tropical storm that came into Texas and then sort of sat. It was Tropical Storm Barry. So it goes into Texas and then it's kind of sitting over central Texas. And what you're seeing on your screen now, we see Kerrville, we see Austin. Make sure that I'm showing this to you appropriately. So Kerrville and Austin, this huge area where not only is there rain, but there's flooding. And so when we're talking about evacuations, you know, between Kerrville and Austin is 2 hours. That entire area probably a little over 2 hours, is completely part of a flood zone, a massive thunderstorm, lightning, rain. So evacuation, I suppose you could go south, you could go west, but you're limited on where you could actually go simply because this storm is so huge. And that's a real key part of this too, as there's a lot of questions about, well, why weren't evacuations issued? What about that? Why didn't that take place? One of the things that officials keep on talking about is a concern. One about crying wolf, you know, hey, there's a flash flood warning. Everyone has to get out. Then there's no flash flood. There's not even rain. You know, what do you do? And also, if you evacuate people and tell them to get to higher ground, how are you also creating another emergency? And like areas that are more prone to hurricanes, where you might have a hurricane lane to drive on the freeway, I don't know in this area if it has anything like that. But a lot of these roads that you're coming out near the river, you know, you're two-lane roads. They're not like these massive highways. So a question about, do we put people on the road and get them trapped is something that officials say that they have struggled with before. So now we're in the morning on Friday. From our understanding of the timeline, this wall of water has already come through as the emergency is being issued. It's already done. It's already happened to some of the worst hit areas. And so now the question is, how do you get people to help? And this was very important. I was able to speak to someone that was one of the first responders to the area. And I've done a lot of interviews about emergency situations. What was described to me just on background, so I'm able to share some of it with you, was one of the most terrifying and horrifying details that I've heard from a first responder of just the danger. They were resolute that they were going to get to this area. And very early on, they were told, there are missing girls. We have to find them. And that mobilized these teams in a way that could really bring you to tears, because they were going to find a way to get to those girls. The problem was the weather. This is also very much an undercovered part of the story. Even as this wall of water rushes through, you're in the middle of a torrential downpour. There's thunder and lightning all around this area. Even getting in a car to drive to the grocery store seems like a question of whether or not maybe you should wait a couple hours to go there. I mean, that's how serious the rain was. So I want you to think about getting in a helicopter and flying through that, and think about how challenging that would be. Yet these teams made a decision. In some cases, they were stopped because it was so dangerous, but then they were able to make a decision and figure out a pathway to get to this area that was so isolated. But getting there was extremely scary, very low visibility, a lot of thunder and lightning, a real question about safety, flying at very low levels to get into an area of visibility. And I'm going to share this one sentiment. One of the people that I talked to said that he really believes that God guided us through it all. He said, because there's really no way to explain how they were able to find a little bit of a break in the weather to get through, to get on the ground, to then start searching. But they're not really able to get anywhere significant until the early afternoon, because it took so long to get those air assets out there and able to get up and search. And even then, and this is, again, not being reported as much as it should be, to be able to fly in these conditions, it's continuing to be really terrible conditions. And yet first responders are risking their lives to find these missing girls, which at this time there's hundreds. We don't know what happened with this particular camp or other camps. And here's another perspective that I think is really important. When you think of an emergency responder, so I'm going to call the fire department, they're going to come to my house. I'm going to give them an address and they're going to look at the crossroads and they're going to be like, this is how we get to Jenna's address. And we're going to show up because that's where her house is. If the roads are washed out and there's no house and there's no landmarks and you are not from the area, how do you find a location? How do you do that? Of course you have maps, but everything looks different now. The river is flowing in a different way. You know, think about the ways that the river is cutting through the land now. And in some cases, first responders had to stop and talk to locals to say, where are we right now so that we can try to find people? And if you're seeing different locations, whether it's cabins, whether you're houses that are ripped from the foundation, you're not even able to see what was previously on the ground there to know that's where you need to search. So this is extremely challenging, very, very difficult. And at least as part of Smarter News, I want to make sure that we honor those that made these sorts of decisions to try to save people's lives, and which they did, and which they did. And one of the numbers that hasn't come across as clearly, it's in the hundreds, is the number of people that have been rescued. And right now we don't have a tally of the total, but hundreds and hundreds of people have been rescued by people either in the air or on the ground, getting them from precarious situations, or at least evacuating them from their homes and getting them help. So by the time the end of the day is happening on July 4th, the magnitude of all of this is now becoming more widely known. We understand that there's missing children from this camp. Those that went into the area said it looks like a bomb went off. It's completely destroyed in certain parts of this river. And then in other parts, like downtown Kerrville, which is an area I'm more familiar with, and the river runs right alongside it, totally fine. No flooding. So this is the sort of dynamics at play. You have a horrific rise of water in a very short period of time. So now that we have a little bit of a timeline, I want to show you something that I think is really important. I think there's three facts that are getting lost in the news. And so I want to show you this one because it's one of the best examples of what happened on the day of the flood. So what you're looking at here is the flood gauge. This is part of USGS, US Geological Survey. And what this is showing us is the flood gauge is something that's going to be floating on the water. It's going to tell us, you know, how high the water gets. And so we can use this in other times. I'm just going to show you the last couple of days. You can see here the flood gauge did rise over, or is at an elevated level over the last 24, 48 hours. What we're seeing in July 2nd, and for those of you listening, I'll explain, is just like a flat line. You know, the water is actually low. It's low, it's low, it's low. As we get to suddenly 1 a.m., when that first alert is issued, it starts to rise. But it's not, it's rising, but it's not, you know, we're not seeing a huge dramatic rise. Even at 3 a.m., you're talking about, you know, I'm just kind of spitballing here, maybe 1 or 2 feet. And then it levels out. By 4 a.m., it's not even past the 5 foot mark. Okay. We're at 1.78 feet at 4:45. And then I'm just going to move it a little bit more. 5 a.m., 1.82 feet. 5:15, 1.82. 5:30, 5.1. Let's get up to 6 a.m., 14 feet. Let's go further, 6:15, 26 feet. Let's go to 32 feet at 6:30. The flood gauge eventually fails. It stops reading. So the reason why this graph is so critical for us all to work through is to see the sudden rise of a wall of water. People talk about it, but it's hard to visualize if you're not there. If you're looking at the same piece of land right now, you're not going to see this. This just shows how dramatically this historic event was. And it happened so quickly in less than an hour. When they're talking about 26 feet, you're talking about 26 to 30 feet in less than an hour. And then just as quickly as it came, it goes down. It doesn't go down to normal levels. But a lot of the images that we're seeing on video, on viral videos, is showing a level that is, let's see, you know, 15 feet lower than it was when it was at its worst. So that gives you some perspective. I think this graph is really important to continue to look at. So I'm just going to leave it on the screen for you here. There's a lot of different estimates of how much water fell. One of the estimates is 1.8 trillion gallons of rainfall in 4 hours. That's the equivalent of 4 months of rain. How about 3 trillion gallons into the Guadalupe River overall? That's the equivalent of the amount of water that the United States uses in a year. This is water at such a high amount. It's not just because of the you know, it's about the intense rainfall, but this buildup of just this rush of water that this area was completely not prepared for. And so the final point that I wanted to just share with you here is going to reiterate another point, which is just this extremely wide swath of area that was impacted by this flood. So it's not just, you know, a 5-mile stretch of river that there can be a lot of attention and intense search on. You're talking about 60 plus miles that need to be searched and looked at over the next several days. And so this is the magnitude that we're talking about. So now that we know what's going on and we have a sense of it, and I should add this context, this idea of flash floods in this area is not new. If you live in the Kerrville area, Kerr County, you will probably have a flash flood warning. Where I live, there are flash flood warnings. The flash flood warning does not tell you to evacuate. It just tells you to heads up, especially in areas. I used to live right off of a low water crossing. Part of the reason we moved is because of that low water crossing would be shut down regularly because you have some water on the road. People can really get in trouble. So this, you know, this idea that there could be a flood of a few feet, of course, there's historical context for that. For this sort of flooding in this speed of time, that's not something that locals have seen. Now, there's comparisons made back to 1987, and there was a flood there. And I want to show you this a flood in this area, actually in July, ironically. So if, you know, the timing of this being summer is also not unknown or unestablished, right? That there has been floods in the summer before. It's not something that just happens in the fall or winter. This is July 16th to 17, 1987, a flash flood in the Guadalupe River near Comfort. So this is very much near this exact area. And in this particular case, there was a camp that decided to evacuate. And as they evacuated, they stalled out on one of these low water crossing bridges. And the water came, and the people that describe this say it basically came at exactly the wrong time, where you looked at that low water crossing and you saw a couple inches of water. No big deal. You drive over that on a regular rainstorm. I mean, just regular life. And this flood of water then took out this bus in a van and led to the death of many, you know, several children in this particular event. So this happened not because the floodwaters came through the cabins. It's because of the way that the evacuation process was happening and a decision to actually leave at daylight, and it turned into this sort of a disaster. So I'm not trying to explain away what officials did and whether or not they made the right decision. I just want you to know that there's precedent for this flood, this sort of flood waters. Again, a huge wall of water, very similar to the one that we saw. But in this case, the evacuation is what actually led, or the choice to evacuate, not like a big swath of the area evacuating, led to the death of these kids. So just something to consider here. I want to show you a soundbite that happened today. And this is the question of, well, what can we do better? What about a heads up? Why were there not warnings in the area? What do we need to know about that? Well, I can confirm to you that people in the area that were camping alongside the river did get a warning in the middle of the night. They got a warning. They looked at it, went back to sleep. This is not unknown in this area. It's not telling you to evacuate. It's not telling you to get out. It's saying that there's a heightened alert. Would you get up and leave at that time in the middle of the night? You just set up camp. It's July 4th. You could get up and leave. You see this stuff all the time. You've probably had a couple of these warnings over the last couple of weeks. Are you leaving? So I want you to listen to this soundbite. Senator Ted Cruz was on scene. One of the senators, Senator Cornyn from Texas, was on scene a few days earlier. I want you to hear this question, the question from the journalist and then the answer from the politician. And they are talking about different things. I'm going to explain because you're going to hear a lot of this.
That first flash flood warning that should have alerted phones at 1:14 in the morning. But we have a federal public database maintained by PBS, PBS Warn, that says the first emergency alert wirelessly here in this area to Kerr County was not until after 9 a.m. That was more than 4 hours after the severe flooding had come to this area. Did you know that? Have you seen that? And what's your response, knowing the state and cuts to the NWS in recent months by this administration?
So I don't know the source for what you're saying. All of the public reporting I've seen is that there were two alerts that went out, one just after 1 a.m., one after 4 a.m. You know, I can tell you, I talked about the partisan finger pointing. I think there have been some eager to point at the National Weather Service and say cuts there led to a lack of warning. I think that's contradicted by the facts. And if you look at the facts, in particular, number one, that these warnings went out hours before the flood became a true emergency level. But number two, the National Weather Service here, New Braunfels is where they were headquartered. They had additional manpower. In fact, they had three additional people working that night, anticipating that it was going to be a very dangerous weather situation. I also think it's worth noting that the National Weather Service Union, which has been very critical of the DOGE cuts, has publicly said that they don't believe that the reduction in staffing had any impact whatsoever on their ability to warn of this event. And so, look, I think it is reasonable over time to engage in a retrospective and say at every level what could have been done better, because all of us would want to prevent this horrific loss of life. But I think just immediately trying to use it for either side to attack their political opponents, I think that's cynical and not the right approach, particularly at a time when we're dealing with a crisis and we're dealing with grief.
Okay, so some of the officials in the area have echoed that same answer of saying now is not the right time. We're happy to talk about it later. The journalists in the press conferences continue to ask this question. And just from speaking as a journalist of 20 years as a veteran, I totally understand why they're asking it. At this point, they're wasting time because they're getting the same answer. And they're not going to get a new answer from officials about whether or not a warning should have been sent out or not. And guess what? I actually discovered something that is really important part to this story about who would actually issue those warnings. Where do you think those alerts come from? The one on your phone that you get, the flash flood warning or the Amber Alert or the different warnings that you get. Who actually gets to do that? Who pushes those alerts to you? Turns out that a variety of different agencies can actually push that alert to you. It's not just one. It's not just the federal government. It's not just your local government or your state. It actually can be the National Weather Service. So let me just read this to you. This is from weather.gov. We're talking about the National Weather Service here. And let's just go to the first question, which is, what are WEA messages? These are wireless emergency alerts. They're emergency messages sent by authorized government alerting authorities through your mobile carrier. Government partners include local and state public safety agencies, FEMA, the FCC, the Department of Homeland Security, and the National Weather Service. No sign up required. Alerts are sent automatically to WEA capable phones during an emergency. So how many times have you actually heard that fact on the news? That in fact, it could be any number of agencies could send something to your phone. Maybe it's the National Weather Service. Maybe it's your local authorities. Maybe it's the federal government. In fact, you could receive a presidential alert from a national emergency through this same system. It's not just one person that gets to hit the red button. And if they don't hit it, then you don't get it. It looks like, and this is what begs further investigation, that sometimes these can go out automatically depending on the weather alert, or they may have to be pushed depending on local authorities. But there's a lot of questions to be asked of a lot of different people about whether or not these alerts were effective. And as I told you, in one case that I heard anecdotally, the woman looked at her phone, saw the alert, and was like, okay, I'm aware. But it didn't say to evacuate. So This is really key. I think this is important to ask this question. A couple questions I have about these alerts is, why does it seem that in some cases it affects certain phones differently? For example, you're in a room, a restaurant, and your phone's going off. Sometimes it's embarrassing, right, with an Amber Alert, but other people, their phones are not, and perhaps they've set off. There's a setting that they don't get that sort of alert. You know, why does it skip over certain people? When I was in my county, there was a flash flood warning by the National Weather Service. I didn't get anything on my phone. I drove into nearby Travis County, into Austin. Immediately, I'm getting alerts on my phone. So what is the mechanism here? And why isn't there consistency? Maybe there's a broader question rather than just talking to those that are, you know, currently elected officials. And this is important because we don't want something like this to happen again. We also want to know what the right language would be to really alert people that this was an emergency. But now that you've seen the map, now that you've seen the way that the flood gauge has moved, even if there was an alert, you're talking about 5 to 10 minutes before that wall of water is at your door. It's beyond comprehension. And I'm not doing this to alleviate, I'm not sharing this reporting to alleviate responsibility of our public officials. I just think this is really important to know. So let's talk about the Doge cuts though. What actually did happen? We know that there were some Doge cuts, right? Well, apparently the Doge layoff cuts impacted 10% of NOAA, which the National Weather Service is a part of. And so we know that the cuts have impacted this agency in some way. In May, you had five former National Weather Service directors publish an open letter saying that these cuts are going to impact the ability of this agency to forecast accurately and have the sort of staffing that you need. And in some cases, we've seen reporting, depending on where you are in the country, that overnight shifts have been pulled back. You know, there's been a lot of question about what is the immediate impact of these cuts. So were those a factor here? Well, I turned to the Texas Tribune, a local newspaper, to see what their reporting was on this, because they, you know, have a reputation for being more independent, probably a little bit more progressive. But their reporting on this particular topic is really important and clutch. And so I just mentioned that because if you're not familiar with the Texas Tribune, I just mentioned kind of this political alignment. Like, do you lean right? Do you lean left? I probably would say they lean left, but for most of the things that they're doing on local reporting, they're pretty straight down the lane as far as how they're reporting this particular story. And this really speaks to that. So one of the things that they quoted from local meteorologists and also from this question about cuts is, I'm just going to read this to you. The flooding came amid concerns about staffing levels at the National.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Weather Service after the Trump administration fired hundreds of meteorologists this year as part of Elon Musk's Doge cuts. The National Weather Service Austin San Antonio offices warning coordination meteorologist announced in April that he was retiring early due to the funding cuts, leading to speculation that vacancies could have impacted forecasters' response. The National Weather Service forecasting offices were operating normally at the time of the disaster, said one of these service coordinators for this particular area. This is a quote: "We had adequate staffing. We had adequate technology. This was us doing our job to the best of our abilities." Remember, they're the ones that were warning people. They're sending out these more urgent alerts starting at 1 a.m. The staffing data provided by the union said that there's four vacancies out of 23 positions in San Angelo, this is out in West Texas, and six vacancies out of 26 in San Antonio. The question I have with that is, are those vacancies sort of normal? You know, for example, was that job opening, has it been open for, 3 years and they're never really at full staffing? Or is that immediate? Did those cuts happen and those jobs are open because they're not going to be filled because of Doge cuts? I don't have the context for that. So I think you should know that we don't know that. One of the legislative directors here said that that the staffing was adequate to issue timely forecasts and warnings before and during the emergency. At least one independent meteorologist working in Texas echoed that statement, writing on his website that, quote, we have seen absolutely nothing to suggest that current staffing or budget issues within NOAA and the National Weather Service played any role in this event. And I think based on the facts, we're seeing that the forecasting wasn't necessarily the problem. The forecasting kept on saying there's a flash flood concern. The forecast, though, did not anticipate the flood gauge being unusable because of the sudden height of the water and that happening in less than an hour time. That's something that the forecasters did not see coming. And the question I would ask now, as we are going to ask more questions, is would the technology enable you to see that? And here's something I'm going to just put out there in case any of you have some insight into this. I'm really looking into AI, and I think AI is a very interesting tool. It's also very scary. Right? It's a little scary about how we're going to use this in our everyday life. But if AI can do some things better than humans, could AI have helped us here? Is this where artificial intelligence can come in and say, if, you know, these 13 variables happen, then we're going to see a wall of water 26, 29, 30 feet high in the next couple hours. And therefore, evacuation should happen. This is a way that I wonder if technology can help us. And I don't know who's working on that technology, but I'm very curious about it. I actually have a couple of people I'm going to reach out to today about it, because that seems to be a way. I don't know if I want artificial intelligence, you know, in the middle of, you know, someone's dating life, but if it can help us in emergency situations, say, hey, these, you know, again, these variables are happening. This storm is going to do that. There's, you know, a 95% probability that this is going to happen. So we're going to have to evacuate people. Imagine that for hurricanes or for what happened in North Carolina. You know, as soon as these components start coming into place, this is when we issue this alert, because this, you know, AI can work faster than humans can and some of the data that's available. So I'm very curious about that. So we'll see. We'll see if I get an answer on it. So those are a couple of things that I just wanted to, I feel like those are the most pressing things that are out there. You know, what actually happened here is one of the questions. And then there's so much focus on, were there leadership decisions made in this situation that led to this disaster? And from listening just methodically to every single press briefing here, my impression reporting on this story is that the storylines by different officials and what we're seeing data-wise are lining up. The city manager in Kerrville says he's running along the water. I was impressed. He got up at 3:30 in the morning. He's going for an early run. It's going to be a big day. There's a lot of people in town for July 4th. The weather doesn't look good. They've gotten some warnings. He's along the river at 4 o'clock in the morning and everything looks fine. And then suddenly at 5 o'clock, he's getting all these alerts. How is that possible? He was there with his own eyes. He saw it. What is possible when you start seeing that flood gauge? And that's what happened. Now, a lot of questions obviously are focused around Camp Mystic. And we're still in the situation here where several children remain missing. And there's an effort to recover these children for families. And there still is an emphasis on hope. You know, in the middle of disaster, that hope could lead to some sort of miracle. Yesterday, there was a lot online, and I'll give you a good example of this. There was an online report, and it came from a variety of different sources that two girls were found in a tree, but no one knew if it was Camp Mystic girls or who it was. Turns out that report wasn't true, but I actually checked with someone that was working on the scene, and they had a report of someone being rescued in the same area where this reporting was taking place. So there was a rescue in the area. It just wasn't the rescue that was described. And so there's a lot of that floating around, a lot of misinformation. I feel like that there's, you know, just a lot of stories and a lot of hope that maybe there could be a miracle in this situation and a lot of efforts to try to get answers as soon as possible. What is going back to the map, and I can actually pull it up for you again. I know it can be difficult to see, is, you know, where the Guadalupe River originates. And as it flows into Kerr County, there's like these two forks in the river. And then there's these bends, and like the camps are not in where the most populated area is, which is, you know, Kerrville and some of these areas where you can go in and actually, you know, there's like a Walmart and there's, you know, a big stretch of restaurants. And there's, by the way, an RV park camp area that my family has gone to for a couple years right on the river. And I thought, oh my gosh, for sure, this thing is totally destroyed. We're never going to be able to go there again. This is awful. There were families there. This is going to be absolutely catastrophic. Wasn't even touched. Everybody was fine. You're 10 feet from the water and everyone was fine there. So these areas are a little bit, I don't know. Sometimes I'll make upstream, downstream. I believe they're upstream. They're closer to the origin source and these kind of these bends in the river. And these are where the camps were and where the camps for like Camp Mystic had been for 100 years. So when the time comes, there's certainly some stories coming out of Camp Mystic, but because these are stories involving children, I just out of an abundance of respect for these families, we're really going to proceed cautiously. I'm hopeful that maybe we could share some insight, but right now what's most important to the families is privacy. And even for those that were able to reunite with their daughters, this is a terror of an event. And in this day and age, when so much is across text message and social media, just imagine trying to work through all of that with all of this energy coming your direction from strangers, from friends, from family. So I'm not ignoring that part of the story, but it's with great sensitivity that I want to protect it. And I can't help but try to do. I'm a, you know, mother of a daughter, and members of our community have been impacted by this. So we're going to protect them, you know? And as they hope to tell their story or as they see fit, we will be a safe space for that. But, and I know that term is overused too, but I do mean it, you know, like a place that they can come and actually tell their story the way they want to, not in a 90-second package that's going to kick off Good Morning America. We're not going to do that. Okay, that's not what we're about here. So I do think Barbara asked such an important question. I'm going to leave you with this. And I do really believe this. Barbara asks, life is heavy and hard, which has me curious. In times like these, what do you do to bring a glimmer of hope back into your days? First of all, I think community is really important. And I'll go back to the news is a story that we share. This is why when we don't see the news reported in a way that feels responsible, it feels like a betrayal. Because we're like, that's not the story, you know, or wait a minute, I don't want that political leaning into this part of the story. Like, give me a second. You know, because it's a story of our lives. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is the power of each of our individual stories. You know, what, even if you weren't in the vicinity of these floods, you've been impacted by them in some way. You're sharing that with the people directly impacted, even from far away. And I do believe our stories are both given to us to help us navigate our life, you know, whatever that is, you know, however the cards are dealt to us, but they're also for us to give away. And when I think about the people that are impacted by what's going on, or if you're feeling like you need to process it, you have to write it down. You know, you are witnessing a very interesting time in history. Even if you're not directly involved in anything that's happening, you know, in a way that you were an eyewitness to an event, you got to write it down. You got to get it out of your body. And you got to think, even if it's writing a letter, you can write a letter to me. You can say, dear Jenna, your kids could find that many years and be like, who's Jenna? Like, who is that lady? But you need to get it out of yourself. You got to both take it in and then you got to get it out. And I think our stories are both for us and then for us to share. And so I think a lot about that when I'm thinking of someone going through something, I want to give them a journal. I want to give them something that they can paint on or draw on and a way to express themselves. And listen, AI is great, but it doesn't do anything like that. There's still a process of that happening. So as you're feeling things, you know, I always keep, what do I have? Oh my gosh, my desk is such a mess. But do you know how many 400,000 notebooks I have? Because there's something always going on and I need to put pen to paper. If I put it on my phone, it gets lost just like everything else. But I think as you're kind of working through this, you know, even if it's writing a letter to a friend and saying, you know, I've really been thinking about what happened in Texas and I just wanted to let you know, I'm thinking of you. These are the sort of things that you're like sharing the story and you're moving the energy. There you go. You just got a little San Francisco for me. It always comes up every once in a while. I'm like, let's burn sage and we'll do some meditation and we'll share the energy. But I also believe in faith and prayer. And one of the reasons why we shared as we started off our coverage for this week is what was actually written in part by the governor of Texas, who made a statewide proclamation for a day of prayer. And two of the lines that he wrote are the following: even as floodwaters raged, neighbors rushed in to rescue, comfort, and bring hope. In times of loss, we turn to God for comfort, healing, and strength. Faith is part of the story too. We don't talk about it in the news because it feels too sensitive. We'll talk about anything else, even the most gritty personal details for people's life, but you talk about what they believe in and suddenly you've crossed the line. We're not going to do that here at Smarter News. It doesn't bother me what you believe, whether it's in God, what other religion you may have or not have, what faith you have, spirituality. When we're in the depths of despair and trying to make sense of a world that feels chaotic, where do you turn? You turn to faith. You turn to something bigger, even a question of whether or not it exists. And so I think that's part of the story. And so we're not going to not acknowledge that and reflect on it. And maybe, we're not here to proselytize to people. There's plenty of other places that will do that, but we're going to acknowledge. And this also was a news event, the governor issuing this proclamation. So something for us to think about as well. In the meantime, I'm just going to check with you guys. I know, thank you to so many of you who have joined us live. And I know there's going to be a lot of questions that will come up. And as they do, I would love to be able to be a source for you. And if you have those questions, if you want to send us an audio message, if you want to just jot us an email, scoop@smarternews.com or hello@smarternews.com, I want to also acknowledge those questions and try to get them answered. So we'll do our best to continue to follow the story. Typically, these press conferences, unless there's a major announcement, sort of dwindle in timing throughout the next week. And we're not going to jump in front of you just to announce the numbers. The numbers of dead or missing. I think that's important, but I also think I want to make sure to acknowledge when we can, just the sadness that comes with each update. And at a certain point, each update can feel a little bit exploitive. So I just want, we're going to continue to watch it. I'll keep you posted as we learn more. And obviously, if there's any big news updates, we'll make sure to flag them for you. But if you have questions and if we need to jump on another live this week, I'm happy to do that. I'm working on a few interviews. I don't know if they're going to come through. The competitive nature in the news industry, sometimes it brings me back to muscle memory. I want to get some of these interviews for you, but sometimes they're not meant to be. So I'm working on a few of them. We'll see what we're able to bring to you. And we'll continue to follow this story along with many others this week. So thank you for your time today. I hope this was helpful, and I look forward to your questions and comments as they develop. But I'm wishing you peace in the week ahead, and also just thank you. Thank you for providing a community for us to do this type of reporting, where I hope we are actually helpful, where the news can be helpful again, not just smarter, but helpful during especially times like this. So give hugs to your loved ones, write some letters this week, jot down some notes, and we'll see you with more on smarternews.com. Have a great day, you guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances. And get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.